From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida lawmakers are considering a bill that would protect adoption agencies from facing litigation if they decide not to work with same-sex couples based on moral or religious beliefs. Supporters point to cities like Boston and San Francisco, where some faith-based child placement agencies no longer provide adoption services for fear of lawsuits from their stance on not adopting children to same-sex couples. Opponents of the bill liken it to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana and say it would violate the state constitution. We'll hear from both sides. Plus, April 16th marks Holocaust Remembrance Day this year. This day of remembrance marks the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising on the Jewish calendar. Seasonal Sanibel resident and Holocaust survivor Steen Metz joins us to tell his compelling story. We'll also find out about Holocaust Remembrance Day events taking place around Southwest Florida. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. Thursday, April 16th will mark Holocaust Remembrance Day. This day marks the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising on the Jewish calendar. It's a time for many to reflect on the lessons learned from the Holocaust and the experiences and atrocities suffered by survivors of the Nazi regime and the approximately 6 million Jews and others who lost their lives in Nazi Germany and other German-occupied territories. For the remainder of the hour, we'll take a closer look at some of the events going on here in Southwest Florida recognizing Holocaust Remembrance Day, and we'll hear one local man's story of survival. Joining me now in studio is Steen Metz. He's a part-time resident of Sanibel Island, author, speaker, and Holocaust survivor. He researched and self-published his own memoir titled A Danish Boy in Theresienstadt. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
Very well.
All right. And he now speaks to school students and a broad range of other public and civic groups about his story. He's a member of the Speakers Bureau at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center and, of course, works with the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida in Naples. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also joined in studio by Ida Margolis. She's chair of the Gen Shoah, which meets monthly at the Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Naples and sponsors other public programs. She's also on the planning committee for the Collier County community-wide HaShoah commemoration. Both of Ida's parents were survivors of Auschwitz. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me also.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation as well. You can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And first of all, you actually pointed out in an email to me several months ago that there are multiple Holocaust Remembrance Days on the calendar. Can you maybe explain the difference a little bit and the significance of this one coming up next Thursday?
I'll be happy to. The one coming up on April the 16th, as you mentioned, is the Holocaust Remembrance Day. This is a day that was initiated in the 1960s. It's commemorates the uprising at the Warsaw Ghetto, and it's according to the Jewish calendar. So it's normally in April or May. This year it's April the 16th. On January 27th, the other day, that was International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and that celebrates the liberation of Auschwitz, and that was established by UN. It was established in 2005 or 10 years ago. So they're both, as far as I'm concerned, very important days.
Okay. And Ida, tell us a little bit about the Gen Shoah group. This is for the descendants of Holocaust survivors.
Yes. Gen Shoah is generations of the Shoah. So they're groups for children of Holocaust survivors. They're all throughout the United States, throughout the world. Some of them have different names. Some are called Next Generation. Some are called Generations After. But there is a national Gen Shoah group. So our group is called Gen Shoah Southwest Florida.
Okay.
But for our group, it's not just children of survivors. We welcome anyone who's interested in Holocaust education and keeping the memories and the history of the Holocaust alive. So we have programs for the public, and everyone is welcome to those.
And as I mentioned, you meet monthly at the Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Naples?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And, Steen, I want to get right to it and hear some of your compelling story. As I understand it, you were a young boy living in Denmark when the Nazi occupation came to your city. I guess let's start there.
It's very interesting because this is an important month. It's also Genocide Awareness Month. And tomorrow, April the 9th, it'll be 75 years since Denmark was occupied by the Nazis. In the first 3.5 years, conditions were relatively normal, especially compared to other occupied countries. But in the fall of 1943, the Danish government resigned. The Nazis gave them ultimatum. They couldn't live with that. They resigned. And that became the beginning of what we refer to as the final solution, the roundup of Jewish people. Most people think that all the Danish Jews, at that time about 7,500, managed to escape to Sweden. Most books talk about the escape to Sweden, and it's a very, very important event. But there hasn't been very much written about the Danes, including my family, who did not manage to escape. We lived in the middle of the country, and we had not been warned. And all the books talk about almost all the Jews have managed to escape to Sweden. It's true, about 95% of them, most of them living in the area of Copenhagen. But when you're among the 5%, that number looms much greater than it really is. And we were arrested one early morning, Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year, and we were transported in what I refer to as a cattle car. Historians refer to it as a box car, but it was a cattle car. It was dirty. We spent about 3 days, 3 nights there, had no idea where we were going, no food, nothing to drink. It was very, very tight, and I was frightened. I was only 8 years old at the time. And then we ended up in Theresienstadt, which is the German version, as you mentioned earlier. Theresien would be the Czech version. And we spent 18 months in the camp, and in my book I refer to it as 18 months in hell.
Yeah. So Theresienstadt in what is now the Czech Republic, and as you mentioned, with so many Danish Jews who did make it out, were there many other Danish people in there with you besides your family?
All Jewish people there, most of them lived outside of Copenhagen. Uh-huh. The people in Copenhagen had been warned by a German diplomat. We were never warned. The phones were disconnected. So there were about 472 Jews that ended up in Theresienstadt. And unfortunately, my father was exposed to some very heavy slave labor, construction work. He couldn't handle it. He was an attorney. He was not used to such heavy work. And he died within 6 months, and he lost 50% of his body weight.
Wow. Was his story fairly common? Did you see lots of men who, you know, died of starvation and exhaustion?
During a period of 3.5 years, 35,000 people died, most of them of starvation, some of them from illnesses such as typhus. And that was 35,000 out of 140,000 that went through the camp. So unfortunately, it was quite common.
And you were just a young child yourself, but did they have you working in the camp as well?
It's interesting you ask that question, because my mother and father, they were both exposed to slave labor. My work was voluntary, and since I was only 8 years old, and my mother thought it would be a good idea because time would pass by faster. So I worked as a messenger or a gopher, and when I talk to students, I always have to remind them that communications quite different in those days. They grew up with the computer, they grew up with the iPhone. We didn't have that technology, so my job was to carry documents, German documents, from one Nazi office to the other. And I spent about 3 or 4 hours doing that.
Hmm. And, tell us about the living conditions in the camp.
Living conditions were bad. My mother and I, since I was only 8 years old, I lived with my mother. We lived on a loft. There were probably 80 or 90 people there from different nationalities, Danes, people from Netherlands, people from Czechoslovakia. We slept on bunk beds, 3 or 4 layers, slept on straw mattress, but very little straw, had thin blanket over us. There were fleas. There were lice. I couldn't understand why I was scratching myself in the morning. So it was pretty bad. What was even worse was it was very difficult to keep clean. I mean, conditions were bad. We didn't have real soap. We didn't have real toilet facilities. And food was very, very – the rations were very, very small. Fortunately, after 6 months, we started getting parcels from Denmark from friends and relatives. Unfortunately, 2 weeks too late for my father, he might have been able to survive. All the Jews in camp, they were entitled to get parcels, but the Danes got more parcels than any other country since we had tremendous support, more support than any other occupied country from Denmark.
And, you know, even with the number of people who did die in the camp that you were in, I understand it wasn't, you know, considered a death camp the way that some others were, but it was on its way to becoming one before it was liberated. Isn't that correct?
That is true. It was not an extermination camp like Auschwitz. A lot of prisoners were sent from Theresa's at Auschwitz to the death camp. But when 35,000 people die, it may not be considered a death camp, but including my father, that's an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
But there had been rumors for a long time that the Germans, the Nazis, were building a gas chamber in Theresienstadt. And it was confirmed by another survivor who was 10 years older than me, and she stayed in the camp to the last minute. And she confirmed that the Nazis were building gas chambers. They started in April. They were supposed to be operational middle of May. We were liberated by the so-called white buses on April the 15th, which would be in a couple of days, 70 years ago. And the camp was liberated by the Soviet troops on May the 8th. It's very eerie to think back what could have happened.
And you know, of the 15,000 children who passed through that camp, I understand that you were one of just about 1,500 that survived.
That is correct, or maybe even fewer than that. But I know in my profile it refers to 1,500. I was very lucky. I mean, people ask me how did I survive. It's first of all luck. Without the parcels, we may not be here either.
And the camp's liberation in 1945, you know, a year and a half after you'd been there, roughly. Tell us about that. The white buses, the Red Cross buses. When you saw them, did you know immediately what was happening?
We had been notified by the chief rabbi in Denmark, who was also in the camp, that we would be liberated. After having been there 18 months, you don't believe it until you see it. And we were very, very, it was probably the happiest day in my life and my mother's when the buses arrived on April the 15th, the so-called white buses, Swedish flags. Sweden was a neutral country. Denmark was still occupied. And we had a convoy of about 20 buses, and they drove through Germany to Denmark. We could not stay in Denmark. Denmark was still occupied, and we ended up in Sweden. And those drivers were very, very courageous because the war was still going on. I still remember we had to stop in a forest. It was heavy bombardment.
And, you know, after the war, you know, I understand you got your education. Looks like you traveled all over Europe, moved to Canada where you met your wife and, you know, eventually ended up in the United States. And you and your wife are raising children. And all these memories are in the back of your mind. Is this something that you talked about openly or very often, or is it something you kind of shut away?
The Holocaust experience, my mother and I didn't talk very much about it. It's typical. Any Holocaust survivor you talk to, they don't really want to talk about it. You'll never forget it. But my mother was trying to protect her, at that time, 10-year-old boy. Right. And whenever we were asked questions, she always said, "Ask me." She wanted to try and forget it, and first of all, for me to forget it, and then focus on the future. But of course, you'll never forget it. It'll never happen. But it was probably a good idea to focus on the future. And it's kind of interesting. For years, I didn't talk much about it. I didn't read much about it. I didn't want to. And then about year 2007, I started writing my memoirs. I did a lot of research. I went back to the camp, Terrorism. And now I cannot talk enough about it or read about it or learning something new about it. So it has really, it's quite a transition.
As you were researching for your memoirs, did you ever find yourself coming across information that just like where like a light went off in your head, you were able to connect something you were reading in history with a memory you'd had that maybe you hadn't really been able to make sense of before?
Happened all the time. I went to the archives in Terrorism, and I got the certificates from my father, the death certificate, and also a certificate of myself and my mother and my grandmother. So it came very much alive. My wife was very concerned about me going back. She thought I would get nightmares. But mm-hmm. I think it helped me get a better understanding, recognizing the places, and certainly get a great appreciation for being one of the few people that survived.
And, you know, now I understand you're very active and really telling, you know, any groups who will listen your story. Do you particularly enjoy talking to school kids as opposed to other groups?
It started with school children, and then later on it developed to civic groups. I want, while I'm able to, I like to talk to as many people as I possibly can, because we cannot do it forever. In 10 or 15 years, none of us will be around. My favorites are probably the middle schoolers. They're totally uninhibited. They ask terrific questions. And my favorite part of the presentation is when we get to question and answers. I never forget a couple of years ago, an eighth grader asked me a question. This was an eighth grader asking me the question, do you feel guilty or lucky being alive? And I thought that was a pretty deep question for eighth grader.
Yeah.
And I would still answer the same way today. I would say maybe I should feel guilty. I don't, but I feel very lucky. Yeah. And I actually keep a folder of all the questions. And one day I'm going to put them in my book, revise my book, and then insert the answers at the same time. So it gives me a great deal of satisfaction. It's more than a mission. It's really a passion of mine.
And as you've already noted, you know, the number of folks like yourself who are able to provide these firsthand accounts, you know, isn't going to be there for the next generation. Do you kind of put that responsibility on groups that you do talk to? Like, you know my story. You're an ambassador of this now. Keep this going.
What I have started doing, whether I talk to school children or other groups, I ask each of them to share my story with at least four people. So they become, as you mentioned, my ambassador and talk about it to family and friends. And as a former business executive, you know, I always had objectives, and now I write down the number of people I talk to. And I've talked to over 13,000 now. So if each one can talk to four people, that will make it over 50,000. And that's
wow.
important for me.
Yeah, yeah.
What I don't want to see happen is, it was 100 years ago, they had the genocide in Turkey. 1.5 million Armenians were murdered, including my wife's grandfather, who was also an attorney. Today, the Turks are denying that it ever happened. There's not a single survivor left after 100 years. And I always draw that parallel when I talk to people. I don't want people in the future to deny that it ever took place. And there are enough already, which is ridiculous, that are denying that the Holocaust ever took place.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the Armenian genocide, as this is the, you know, this year marks the centennial of that. And,
that's right.
And the U.S. has yet to fully recognize the Armenian genocide.
That's absolutely right. And I understand Israel is not recognizing it either. And of course, the Turks have not recognized, which I don't understand. And I'm so afraid that the same thing will happen with the Holocaust, even though it's well documented. There have been thousands of books written. There are museums in Naples, there are museums, Houston, Chicago, and of course the big one in Washington, D.C.
And Ida, when it comes to your own parents, you know, before they passed, were they vocal the way that Steen has become and sharing their own stories?
Well, it took a while also because it's almost parallels what he said, that for a while they really didn't want to talk about it at all. Mm-hmm. And then it's really like after the miniseries Holocaust was on TV, it almost gave people like permission to start speaking. And that's when school started contacting my mother and father. My father never spoke. He lost everyone, his entire family, his wife, his daughter, everyone. My mother still had a sister who lived through the war. She lost everybody else. But she was a wonderful speaker. And the same feelings that Steen has over here with talking to the children at the schools and saying the same thing, you know, please, the most important thing you can do is remember my story and tell someone else. Both my parents are gone now. So it's just really important that you know, the survivors who are left, I give them so much credit. It was hard for her every time. It's not easy. It's not like, you know, I was a history teacher. It's not like me giving my history lesson about the Civil War. I mean, this was difficult every time they did the story. It took a lot out of her. And I just give them so much credit for doing that because it's just such an important task to go in front of the students and tell their story.
Well, we do have a few minutes left. Ida, can you tell us maybe about some of the Holocaust Remembrance Day events that are going to be going on here in our community?
Yes. For the community-wide Yom HaShoah for Collier County, we're going to be Wednesday the 15th at 5 p.m. at Temple Shalom, which is at 4630 Pine Ridge Road. And this is collaboratively sponsored by the Federation, the Holocaust Museum, our local temples, as well as the Jen Shoah Group. And all members of the community are invited to a program. It'll be about a 40-minute program, and we're going to follow it with a community art project to commemorate Yom HaShoah. So that's going to be for Collier County. Interestingly enough, there's going to be a play right here at FGCU.
I just saw that today.
Yeah. So I think that's fabulous. That's going to be on the 14th at, I think it's 7 o'clock here at FGCU at Edwards Hall. And that's to commemorate Yom HaShoah there. And it's, you know, different places throughout our area. It's going to be in Lee County. They'll have theirs at Temple Beth Shalom at April 19th also. But I think it's really wonderful. I just want to mention that the Archdiocese, the Diocese of Venice is hosting a Holocaust Remembrance Day also, which I think is just a real, really wonderful thing. And that's on Sunday, April 19th at 2:30. And that's at the Epiphany Cathedral in Venice, Florida.
All right. And I will make sure that we have a comprehensive list compiled here. So if folks want to find out about events going on in their community next week, you can visit wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Look for the link to this conversation and we'll have all that information located there. You can probably also find information at the website for the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida in Naples. That is all the time we have for today's show. But thank you so much, Steen Metz and Ida Margolis, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for helping bring awareness to the Holocaust.
Steen Metz is a part-time Sanibel resident and Holocaust survivor, author, and speaker. Ida Margolis is chair of the local Jen Shoah group. That's Jen Shoah of Southwest Florida. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.